The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are M. Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Power, and Frank Muir. Round one tries to see if they've got any vocabulary. 2 marks if they get these words approximately right. We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is a megaton?
Well, something very large.
Very large indeed.
It sounds sort of word the Americans invented, too. I don't know if it's a real genuine word.
Mm-hmm.
It's a million tons.
Yeah. Applied normally to.
Oh, bombs, I should think.
Yeah. That's good enough. 2 marks. It's a million tons. It's normally used as a measure of the explosive force of a hydrogen bomb, which is equal to that, which is a horrifying thought, of 1 million tons of TNT, which is a normal explosive. 2 marks. Frank Muir, what is nosography? N-O-S-O-G-R-A-P-H-Y. Nosography.
Oh, it's the study of the nos.
It is, in fact, but I want to know
I
what
said
the nos
it was.
Is.
Nos, nes, nose.
Nos, no.
It's the second lesson that opticians have to learn. The first is to do with the location of the ears. Otherwise, the spectacles might have a forward or backward movement. And the other thing is to locate the nos, or nose. Otherwise, they'll have an up and down movement. Nothing to do with eating. No, it's nosh.
No, sorry, it's nosh. I'm sorry, you're not going to get it. It's a systematic description of diseases, and it comes from the Greek word nosos, meaning a disease. Sorry. Dillis Powell, what is or was a sibyl?
She was a prophetess in the ancient world. And she very frequently sat on a rock under which there was a kind of volcanic smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And this rather cheered her up or drove her into a frenzy, and she prophesied and told people to go home and win a battle or lose it or beat their wives or whatever.
Pretty accurate description. I think you get your 2 marks. To the Greeks, she was a woman who acted not only as a prophetess, Dillis, but as mouthpiece to some particular god, and she produced a whole series of oracles and prophecies like the Cumaean Sibyl. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what is a mangel wurzel?
Well, a mangel wurzel is a sort of succulent Swede. it's a kind of a crop. Cattle eat it.
I think you've got the essential points that it's a root plant and it's used as cattle food. It is, in fact, a kind of beet. It can be used jocularly to denote somebody who's extremely rustic or rural, sort of countrified sound. But it is a German word. Mangel meaning beet, and Wurzel meaning root. And it just does mean beet root. Well, before we begin round two, what I do is to give each team a quotation for them to write down. And only 2 women members of the teams, I hope, will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Anne Scott James and Dennis, here's your quotation. Legs are staple products. And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is, blow you, Jack, I'm all right. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these words came to be said or written. The next round's about verse and poetry, and I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to finish it off the next line or two. 2 marks if they can complete the quotation, and 2 more for naming author and poem. Anne Scott James, 4 grey walls and 4 great towers overlook a space of flowers, and the silent isle embowers.
It's Tennyson.
Yes.
And the next line is the Lady of Shalott.
Quite right.
Is that all I have to do?
Yes, all you have to do is absolutely spend it. You get 4 marks. Now, Frank Muir. When she is by, I leave my work. I love her so sincerely. My master comes like any Turk and bangs me most severely. but let him bang his belly full.
What a rotten poem. Let him bang his belly full. But he's eating... Eh? Is it? Oh, yes. Memory has come flooding back. Not Sally on Ellie, it's Sally in Ellie. Yeah. It comes from that lovely, well-known ballad, Sally in Our Alley.
Yes. Would you like to finish off the bit that I started?
It's written by the Japanese. And Harry Carey.
But, yes, quite right, those two, right?
She's the darling of my heart.
And she lives
in Our Alley.
Mm. Yeah. Two and a half.
Three.
Sally in Our Alley by Henry Carey. That was quite right. My master comes like any Turk and bangs me most severely, but let him bang his belly full. I'll bear it all for Sally. She is the darling of my heart, and she lives in our alley. Two and a half. To this pal. And she made him a feast at his earnest wish of eggs and buttercups fried with fish, and she said it's a fact the whole world knows.
Is that the one with the buttercups?
Nobody's better without any toes.
Yes.
it's Edward Lear.
Yes. That's all right. Can you finish off the thing? And she said it's a fact the whole world knows that...
A poggle is better without any toes.
That's right. Well done. Four marks. This is the pobble who has no toes, and it ends off this particular bit, that pobbles are happier without their toes. Well done. Four marks. Dennis Norden. But children, you should never let your angry passions rise. Your little hands were never made...
This is Victorian, it must be. Is this Birds in Their Little Nests Agree? Well, it's the poem that's got Birds in Their Little Nests Must Agree in it. I don't know who wrote it. I don't know anything about it. It used to be a bestseller on calendars.
Was it a woman?
No.
Oh, I thought it was one of those...
No, there were lots of contemporaries who were women. This is,
There's always lots of contemporaries.
Not
women, otherwise there wouldn't be any...
Watts, was it?
Yes, well done, yes.
Watts. Oh, good.
I'll help you a little, see if you can get the last line. But children, you should never let your angry passions rise. Your little hands were never made
to...
Gouge out children's eyes.
To gouge out your sister's eyes.
Yes, all right, that'll do. It's not absolutely dead accurate. It would have been a bit shocking to the Victorians. This is Isaac Watts. Divine songs for children. These were hymns. One called Against Quarrelling, and it ends, Your little hands were never made to tear each other's eyes. I think you earn your four marks. Well, now we have a round of origins and derivations, which is a bit more complicated. Three marks possible. If members of the team can first of all define the present meaning and then give me the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. Anne Scott James. Diamond.
Well, it's an enormously precious and valuable stone, which are a girl's best friend.
Yes, that's fair enough.
Isn't it strange that diamonds are a girl's best friend, but a dog is a man's best friend? Ever pondered?
What's it made of? Yeah?
What's it made of? Mm. Oh, sort of something earthy or ory or whatever.
Depends
what
who
have
gives
you.
It to you, dear, actually.
Yes, exactly.
All right, the diamond is a colourless... or tinted precious stone made of pure carbon crystallized into octahedrons. But it's a corruption of this Greek word adamas or adamant, meaning untamable, something that can't be subdued. And that comes from the fact that a diamond can cut other substances but can't be cut itself normally by anything except another diamond. And that's why it's come to mean the word adamant, a general meaning of hardness or firmness. Frank Muir, Dundreary Whiskers.
Dundreary Whiskers are long sideboards.
Yes. It comes from?
It comes from a play.
Yes.
A very famous play of its time called Our American Cousin.
Well done.
And the character in it, who was a sort of archetypal stupid nobleman, was called Lord Dundreary. And it became very fashionable in London... And in America, too, actually. And chaps went around and grew Dundreary Whiskers. Such was the rage the play had.
Hold on, Frank. Dennis Powell, Armageddon.
Armageddon was the kind of battle between good and evil forces which was supposed to bring about the end of the world, I thought.
Yes, that's right.
It was the First World War was often referred to as Armageddon.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that'll do. I think you'll get your full marks for that. It's the name given to the battle which is supposed to be proving one day to be the great and final battle between the nations just before the Day of Judgment. And it derives from the name given to the site of this battle in the Revelations in the Apocalypse. And he gathered them together in a place called, in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. And there was the battle of that great day of God Almighty. Dennis Norden, what is a solecism and why so called?
Solecism is a breach of good manners or etiquette. If you are at a dinner and you cough your wine and instead of eating the peas with a fork, you put them in the groove of a stick of celery and roll them down. That would be a solecism. Now, it also means a word.
Yes.
It's become to be used as a word, or it was originally a word used wrongly. I don't know, one precedes yes, the other, as these yes. things always do.
It's a deviation from correct grammar or blunder in your speaking or writing, but also, as Dennis quite rightly says, it has come to mean a breach of good manners or an impropriety. But the original meaning was the verbal mistake, and it comes from the Greek soloikos. Came from the town of Soloi in Cilicia, where there were barbarians, according to Greek ideas, who spoke rather incorrectly, because the town had been taken over by Athenian colonists who spoke a very debased form of Greek, and in consequence the word solecism began to happen. Now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, and Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Legs are staple products.
Well, it's not often that I really know the answer 100% for sure, but this time I'm certain of it. A tycoon was talking to Flo Ziegfeld and discussing what he should go into, and whether she'd go into steel or into chemicals or into railroads, into oil. And Flo Ziegfeld said, no, sir, legs are staple products.
I'm sure that's absolutely accurate. I'm going to give you 1 out of 2. Because
hard to prove it wrong, isn't it?
No, I can't prove it wrong, which isn't the first time it was used. The original quotation was, legs are staple products and will never go out of fashion while the world lasts. And this was two characters who were flourished in about 1866, called Jarrett and Palmer, and they were speaking about a famous and magical and spectacular drama which they themselves had produced, which was, I suppose, mainly legs. Well, now, Dennis Powell, I like the origin of your quotation. Blow you, Jack, I'm all right.
I'd bound to say I know it in a rather ruder form.
Yes, there are lots of forms, but I hope you won't repeat it.
A polite version, a sayable version of the naval version is take the ladder away, Jack, I'm fireproof. It's what you asked Jack to do, which is the variable, really.
That's it, yes. Yes, and we won't go into that at all, Frank.
No, you Jack, I'm all right. There was a film, too.
There was a film, yes.
A services expression from World War II, and it exists in many versions, including a film with Peter Sellers in it. Well, now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norden with his legs are staple products.
In a previous programme, I went binding on at some length and considerable depth about the fact that I had put on some weight and had to lose some, was told to lose some. And losing weight is just about the most boring and dreary thing that one has to do nowadays. First, it's all those calculations you have to make the whole time, you know, and how many calories are there in the glue on the back of trading stamps, you know. and a kind of mean little stratagems you have to get up to, like working out that you'll get a better reading on the weighing machine if you shave before you get it. Has not intrigued the people in the chemist shop, that does as well. And finally, I did this for some week, and I got fed up with it. I got absolutely fed up with it. And it was the doctor who told me. So, and I went along to him, and I said, why have I got to lose weight? I mean, what do you base your calculations on? And he showed me this chart, you see, which has got it all worked out that people of a certain height should weigh a certain amount, you see, and I weighed too much for my height. Well, the solution came upon me in a flash. To go into all this business of losing weight, the thing to do is to gain height. You see, well, the doctor immediately saw the logic of this. And I said, instead of trying to take off 10 pounds, all I have to do is put on 3 inches. I went away determined to do this. It's not that easy, actually. I don't know if you thought about... Think of your body, as it were, in vertical plan, you see, and then you'll see that there are 4 areas of it which are, as it were, susceptible to lengthening. There's the head, the neck, the trunk or torso, and the legs, you see. When I started with the head, this can be done theoretically by applying enormous pressure to both ears. Now, as when you listen to a stereophonic record in a small room. But it's a dicey one. So I moved on to the neck. I went down to one of those surgical appliance shops in the Charing Cross Road. I said to the man, have you got anything I could use for stretching my neck? Well, I don't know if he was just in a grumpy mood that day, but I didn't fancy the thing he made up for me. It's not just the noose bit. It just, you know. So I forgot that and moved on to the idea of elongating my trunk or torso. Now, this I found a rather ingenious way of doing, I thought, and that was to wear very heavy trousers. You see the principle, don't you? The trousers go around the waist, and by exerting a constant downward pull, you should, in theory, lengthen that area of the body. So I stuffed a lot of round, heavy lead weights in my trouser pocket, walked about like that for about a month. I only packed it in because of this terrible argument with the taxi driver in the dark. I would have sworn it was a half crown that I'd given him. Anyway, he got rather nasty. So there I was, left with the legs. Now, we often use the phrase, don't we? I think I'd like to stretch my legs. Have you ever tried it? You see, obviously, the first thing that springs to mind is, you could do it if you had some force that was exerting a constant, steadily maintained pull on it. But that's very difficult to achieve during an ordinary working day. And what I was forced to do in the end was to rig up a device. I laid flat on my bed, you see. Round each toe, I tied a bit of strong nylon cord. I bought the 10 ends of that cord and fixed them to a strong rope which led out the window. And at the other end of the rope, a friend came round every evening and hung the garden roller. Now, you see, now in theory it should work, shouldn't it? I slept like that for 7 weeks. And yesterday, I measured myself. I haven't gained an inch in height, not an inch, not a millimetre, but I now take size 16 shoes. So I am forced to the conclusion that these 2 lower extremities can neither be altered or adjusted, or in the words of Jarrett and Palmer, who, as you heard, flourished around 1866. What they flourished is lost in the mists of history. But legs are stable products.
Well, we should have to tell Dennis about the Tower of London and the rack. He might try that next time. And now, back to Frank Muir, and if you'll remember, his quotation was, "Blow you, Jack, I'm all right."
At 11:45, last night, I suffered the final humiliation, the final social degradation. I was breathalyzed. Now, for those of our listeners overseas, or who work in lighthouses, or members of the government, all those people who are out of touch with daily life in these islands as they are lived, I must explain that the police have brought in now this breathalyzer test thing. If they suspect the driver's been drinking, you blow into a plastic balloon, and then you let it go. Rather like parties, where they usually, when you let it go, they blow a raspberry. But if you've been drinking, the raspberry that it blows at you is a raspberry to the extent of £100 fine, 4 months in jail, and disqualification for driving. I live in a village, Thorpe, in Surrey, and the trains don't go there. There's only one bus an hour, and it leaves the stop at the end of my gate, and it doesn't arrive anywhere. It just sort of goes. It must lose an awful lot of buses in a year. So one has to have a car. Well, the obvious answer, people say, well, it's quite easy. If you've been drinking, you just have a hired car. Now, I was doing a television show, and the television show went on at 10:30. And at night, needless to say, one had to appear live. Well, I had a light ale beforehand and did the show and was so pleased with myself at not falling over the scenery and not being hissed off the set that I had a couple of gins afterwards, you know, just to relax. And I realised that I had this 20-mile drive. So the producer of the show said, "Don't worry, have the firm's car and chauffeur." So I said, "Well, I don't want a car. I've got a car. It's just this driving bit." He said, well, have the chauffeur. So we got in the car with the chauffeur. A nice chap. He comes into the story rather largely, so I'll tell you about him. Fred, his name was. 42, just married. Previous weekend. Built like a jockey. 4'2". He had to wheel the front seat forward. And I'm 6'6". So I had to go into a sort of prenatal crouch. The only way I could sit at all was to dig my toes into the glove compartment and sort of sit on the back of my neck. And he told me all about his marriage all the way home, and I was dog-tired and was saying, "Yes, Fred, yes, Fred." So when we arrived home, I thought we must invite him in, because I haven't been very sociable to him. And I said, "Darling, this is Fred. He drove me home because of the breathalyzer." And we gave him a cup of tea and 9 biscuits. And he said, "Well, I'd better be getting back," you know, and went, you know, and we started getting ready to go to bed, and there was a ring on the front door. And Fred came in and said, "I can't find my car." So we had a look, you know, and there's no car. And then the truth dawned. I said, "But you haven't got a car." "You came home in my car." He said, "Blimey, yes." He said, "Well, I'll take your car back with me to town now." But I said, "Well, how am I going to get up in the morning?" So I said, "I know, Fred, you stay the night." He said, "I just got married, sir." I said, "No, Fred, it's the easiest thing. You stay the night, I'll drive you back. My car will be in London, we'll be all set." I said, "Don't worry, Fred. Put him to bed in the spare bedroom. In the morning, just about set off, my wife suddenly had a much better idea. She said, I want to do some shopping in London." So he said, "Marvellous idea." So we all piled in my car, and Fred drove. We felt marvellous sitting in the back. And my wife said, "Well, that's fine, because we've got to go to dinner with the Windlers tonight." So we went to the party, you see, and they were very hospitable. And after about 5 drinks, you see, I don't drink very much, you know, 5 quadruple gins during the... we were just sitting in my car, and she suddenly said, "The breathalyzer test." So I said, "What do you mean? I'm perfectly capable of driving." She said, "The breathalyzer test, you don't drive." I said, "Oh. She said, well, ring Fred. He won't. I said, no. I said, I don't care. I'll risk it. I'm perfectly capable. We've got to hit another car before the police make you blow into the balloon and look at the crystals and everything. I'm perfectly capable of driving. She said, are you sure? I said, yes, come on, let's risk it. So I got in the car, backed smartly into a police car. Just a moment, sir. Have you been drinking? I said, only socially, officer, and it doesn't affect my driving. He said, well, will you breathe into this thing? And he said, you just breathe in very steadily with a sort of... very steadily. I will check the colour, whether it's turned green, and then you'll know whether you're all right to continue. And, well, what happened? Actually, I can describe it in one sentence. My taking the breathalyzer test was blow, shoo, check, I'm all right.
I'm bound to warn Frank that it won't work a second time. But by your vote, he wins the contest of the two stories. And that brings us to a final score in which Dillis Powell and Frank Muir win by one mark from Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden. And that also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. Thank you.